Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Welcome to Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to understanding where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zakheim, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute, and thank all of you for tuning in to the inaugural episode of our show. We're excited for all of you to join us for a series of conversations aimed at understanding how the principles and beliefs of our 40th president continue to impact us today. Now, for our first episode of the show, I have here with me in our Reagan Institute offices a renowned Reagan scholar and a friend of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, Mr. Craig Shirley. Craig, great to have you here.
Thank you, Roger, very much. It's great to be here.
So I'm just going to give everybody who's listening a quick bio sketch. It's not exhaustive, but at least instructive of what you've done. And I'm going to start at the ripe old age of 8 years old, where, Craig, I'm told you canvassed for Barry Goldwater.
I went door-to-door for Barry Goldwater when I was 8 years old.
That's amazing. We're somehow going to have to work that in. And then worked
I'll tell you a story about when I saw the senator years later, and I told him that I went door-to-door for him, and it was a funny thing. It was a funny incident.
That's amazing. I guess child labor is okay for Barry Goldwater.
Yes.
Worked in government and on campaigns for 3 decades, including, and relevant to this conversation, Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign in 1980, and other senior positions you held at the National Republican Committee. And then really after President Reagan's reelection in 1984, you opened up your own PR firm and worked in close coordination with the Reagan White House. So really kind of live interaction with the figure that we're discussing. And that involved things ranging from the Strategic Defense Initiative to supporting the Tax Reform Act of 1986. But the scholarship piece comes after, and you authored 6 books and dozens of articles on President Reagan and continue to do that regularly, and really a key person in preserving and promoting the legacy of President Reagan. So really grateful that you're here with us today for an argue episode on Reaganism. So
thank you.
How about we just jump right into it? There are 4 books I think you've written on President Reagan, and I guess I wanted to just hit on, take us through kind of why you chose to spend so much of your time and effort on this, and kind of what was that moment of epiphany that you felt this was something that needed to be done?
Many years ago, Roger, I had I still have a client, Thomas Nelson Publishing out of Nashville, Tennessee. And we had a standing order from the publisher. We were doing the the public affairs division. The name has changed. I don't recall it now from that long ago. But anyway, we had a standing order. If we ever had a good idea for a book, we were supposed to pass it along. Well, one day, the president of the division was a fellow by the name of David Dunham, who was a wonderful individual. And I called him one day and said, nobody's ever done a comprehensive book on Reagan's 1976 challenge to Gerald Ford when he narrowly lost the nomination. So we talked it through, and he said, well, I like the idea. And I said, look, the Reagan's always said it was the most exciting campaign. Of his 5 campaigns, 2 for governor, 3 for president, he said it was the most exciting of all 5 campaigns. And Mrs. Reagan always said it was the most thrilling of all the 5 campaigns. And Reagan always said so himself. And David says, well, why don't you see if somebody who wants to write it? So I spent the next couple of weeks talking to political reporters, columnists, and activists here in Washington. And they either were disinterested, didn't have the time, or for whatever reason, they couldn't do the book. So I reported this news back to David. And David said to me, there's a long pause. I'll never forget the conversation. He says, well, why don't you write it? And I had never, I kind of toyed around with the idea of novels or things like that. And I was a history major in college and loved history. We were immersed in it as children. My father took me to every battlefield, known to man, Revolutionary War and Civil War battlefields and Mount Vernon and Monticello, every place. That was a family vacation, was go to Saratoga,
right.
go to Fort Ticonderoga. And so he said, why don't you write? And I thought about it for about 3/4 of a second. I said, sure.
Game on.
Yeah, game on. Yeah, exactly.
And the rest is history.
And so I wrote it.
So let's pivot, because you talk about the first book and Reagan's Revolution. And that language of revolution really just captures how Reagan really led a movement and change. And so and, one of the things that we're trying to do here, which I hope you can elaborate on, is, all right, we tend to refer to that as Reaganism, right? The name of this podcast is Reaganism.
Yes.
Take us through the elements of Reaganism.
Well, you just hit on it, Roger, is that a lot of people at the Washington Post and other establishmentarians and liberals and people who don't understand Ronald Reagan say he was a reactionary. He was anything but a reactionary. Reagan was a revolutionary. Reagan always challenged conventional wisdom, especially in national politics, is that on issue after issue after issue, whether it was tax cuts, SDI, federalism, all these were anti-establishment initiatives. And his very presence on the national stage was a challenge to Richard Nixon in 68. He was the insurgent. It was a challenge to Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was the establishment. Reagan was anti-establishment. In 1980, George Bush was the establishment. Howard Baker was the establishment. John Connolly was the establishment. Reagan was anti-establishment. Everything he embraced, everything he pronounced, challenged conventional wisdom.
Were they particular policies? You just hit off on a few. Were there principles that really made him depart from, quote unquote, you're describing the establishment?
At the end of the American Revolution, Benjamin Rush wrote a letter to Thomas Paine in which he said, "The war is over, but the revolution goes on," which meant that their political philosophy, which Reagan, out of the library, what are the two documents that are inscribed on the wall? The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Those were Reagan's inspirations. And the Declaration of Independence is a revolutionary document. So it's, one is a prenup, the other is a divorce decree. The Declaration is a divorce decree. "We're divorcing you, King George, because you have sullied our courts, because you've sent troops into our homes, because you have shut down our legislature. So this is, we're filing papers for a divorce." It's a revolutionary concept, and Reagan took his inspiration from this, is that to always challenge the status quo. And so when Rush writes that letter, Reagan could have written that letter, is that he's always in a state of revolution, and I think the proper state of American conservatism is to always be in a state of revolution.
Against what?
Against the establishment, against the status quo, against the established order, against anything that is presupposes that what they're doing is right.
So let's press that for a minute more, and then I want to shift to you at 8 years old. But before we do that, yes, it's a revolution, but it's still going back to core principles.
Sure.
Right? I mean, and that's so right. That's what I think is so unique about when I read Reagan. It's freedoms.
Yes.
It's those lines from our Declaration of Independence. I mean, a lot of his presidency is trying to bring Americans back to our foundational principles.
Right.
Why is that revolutionary?
Because there are different forms of revolution. There are economic revolutions, there are social revolutions, there are cultural revolutions, there are political revolutions. Reagan was not a tear-down-the-government revolutionary, but he was a pro-freedom revolutionary. He always was pushing back against, and this is, he liked third options. The Cold War, what were the two options? Nuclear war, mutually assured destruction, or surrender. But he comes up with a third option, which is SDI, and to beat them economically. Nobody ever thought of that before, not from Truman on forward. Nobody ever said, well, let's spend them into oblivion.
Right.
Let's build our defenses into oblivion. Let's use our technology to send them into oblivion.
So that's Reagan. You're, you know, fast forward to their presidency.
Right.
But when you're eight, it was Goldwater.
Yes.
And in the world of Reagan and Reaganism, the ideas of Reagan, the coming out party essentially was the time for choosing speech.
That speech address was important to me too.
Where were you at that time?
So my father was chairman of the Onondaga County Conservative Party for a time. Well, as you can imagine, in 64, our house was a hotbed of Goldwater activity.
Right.
You know, we were kind of the distributor for Goldwaterism for upstate New York, you know. And
Goldwaterism, you don't hear much of that.
no, not anymore. Anyway, is that one of the things they had that I was doing when I was 8 years old was distributing literature door-to-door for Barry Goldwater. Many, many years later, 1977, I'm interning in the U.S. Capitol for the U.S. Senate, and I'm delivering a message one day to my senator, who ironically was Jacob Javits.
Okay.
I was interning for Jacob Javits, one of the very men that was a liberal Republican that my parents despised. And I'm flying down a flight of stairs to deliver a message to Senator Javits over on the Senate floor. And I go running past this elderly man who's limping down the stairs. And I said, I know who that is. And I turn around, it's Barry Goldwater.
It's the senator from Arizona.
So I'm 19 years old. I have to introduce myself. Senator Goldwater, my name is Craig Shirley. In 1964, I went door to door for you to search in New York. You know, nervous right. and fast talking and all that. And Goldwater looks at me and he says, bitch, got a door slammed in your face. And as a matter of fact, I did get some
well doors. A well-earned scar is formative.
Yeah.
So, but let's talk about the time for choosing speech, because
right.
it was that moment where President, the time, you know, Governor Reagan, before being Governor Reagan, comes out to the political world.
Yes.
And kind of shares his worldview.
Right.
What are those elements there? Is that in of that speech and kind of really define Reagan at that time?
It completely defines Reagan. Actually, my father in 65 came home with a record album, and he made my brother and my sister and myself sit down and listen to it.
Record album of The Time for Choosing speech.
The Time for Choosing, which is actually, the record album was called Rendezvous with Destiny, which was one of his favorite phrases, because he got that from Franklin Roosevelt. We can go into that later. But anyway, my father makes us sit down and listen to it. I'm 8, 9 years old. And after listening to the speech on record, my father stands up and says, this man Reagan himself should be president. That was in 1965.
Prescient.
Yes, prescient. So, absolutely.
So,
yes.
But
speech is Reagan's coming out party. It's the one bright light in an otherwise awful campaign in which Barry Goldwater is smashed, mm-hmm. you know, 61-39. He only carries 6 states. Is that conservatism is pronounced dead. The only clear-thinking intellectuals embrace the modern government state and the modern activist government state interfering in the affairs of man, and that's how all sophisticated people know that, and is that conservatism is just a rash of irritable mental gestures, as Lionel Trilling wrote mm-hmm. in his book, The Liberal Imagination, in 1951. You know, conservatism was dismissed as just being...
And so here,
you
comes
to be
Reagan, here comes Reagan with his speech.
Exactly.
So we'll play the clip and get your reaction.
You and I are told increasingly we have to choose between a left or right. Well, I'd like to suggest there is no such thing as a left or right. There's only an up or down. Man's old age dream, the ultimate in individual freedom consistent with law and order, or down to the ant heap of totalitarianism. And regardless of their sincerity, their humanitarian motives, those who would trade our freedom for security have embarked on this downward course.
I love this quote mostly because it jettisons, you know, directionally the left and right.
Correct.
And it tells people what is only natural, which is you just want to rise.
And this could not apply more today if Reagan was alive and standing here right now and issuing this, is that I've always said American liberalism derives its inspiration from the French Revolution. And so it's not a choice between a left or right, as Reagan says. It's either up or down, because what they want, the French Revolution was about the destruction of all, of everything, of society and culture, the destruction of marriage, money, religion, property, everything. Because the Jacobins thought the only way to recreate society is to start out with everybody naked, alone, owning nothing, is to start over again. And the Jacobins of the American left of 1964 and of 2019 also believe that. Is that they really, I mean, everything that they do is really about the destruction of institutions, of laws, of
redistribution.
Redistribution, the destruction of wealth, the destruction of success, the destruction.
But also.
Everything, or even House League soccer.
But what Reagan.
Is representative.
But what
of,
Reagan and the real battleground for that is the role of the government.
Yes.
And it, you know. It seems to be the centerpiece of the speech
yes.
in Reagan's political philosophy. Love the line, which is oft repeated, but he says, no government ever voluntarily reduces itself inside. Government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth.
He's right. He's sure. Is that we still the government still funds the naval helium program, tune of $30 million. The Navy hasn't been stockpiling helium since the 1930s, but we still fund it every year for their dirigibles.
Defense dollars, you know,
sensitive to that. But yes, it's probably not the best allocation of defense money. No,
I'm all for defense spending. It's just for wise defense. But how many programs are duplicated in the federal government? How many welfare programs? How many unemployment programs? How many agricultural programs? How many subsidy programs are duplicated throughout? And by the way, they know it's duplicated. They just want to, but the more bureaucracy means less freedom.
Let's go to really the heart of what we're going to explore during this session, which is Reaganism and the factions of Reaganism. So I'll ask you to buckle your seatbelt because I know you can get exercise on this subject here.
So am I being too hot in this interview? Am I being too hot?
No, you're doing fantastic. No, but I'm saying, but as we go down this road in terms of laying out the different approaches to Reaganism, and it's pretty remarkable that there seems to be rising kind of voices from across the political spectrum who invoke President Reagan's legacy. Sure. And it's a legacy that could be a unifying force in America and perhaps bridge the gap between those who disagree. But at the same time, there seems to be different factions of Reaganism. And, yes. And I guess even in this conversation we've outlined, you have establishment Republicans and their view of kind of Reaganism.
Which
you have the
wrong
movement Republicans, perhaps those who feel that they carried the Reagan Revolution. You have a view that there is actually the Reagan Democrat or the New Deal Republicans and they associate with Reagan.
Nonsense.
And then you have kind of the freedom agenda.
That's
and
right.
Kind of the neoconservative movement, which is also an outgrowth. So I guess two questions on that, which I'd love for you to hit on. One, take us through those different factions where you see, you know, the one that really needs to be, ones that are the most vibrant and true to Reagan. And then the flip side is, you know, kind of an assessment of the state of Reaganism today.
Okay.
For our listeners, that was a deep sigh.
I'm gathering my thoughts.
Okay, right? Okay.
Is that Reaganism and Ronald Reagan is not a Rorschach test, but too many people see it as, and they derive different things to justify their own positions. Neocons do it. You know, there was a nonsensical book written a couple years ago arguing that Reagan was a New Deal conservative, which is ridiculous. Is that too many people view Reagan through their own justified prism instead of just taking Reaganism for what it means, which is about individuality, maximum freedom consistent with law and order, privacy, dignity, is that Reagan used to call himself a libertarian Republican or libertarian conservative. And I think we ought to take the man at face values is that he wasn't libertine, but he was a small L libertarian. In 1974-75, he used to call himself a libertarian. And as a matter of fact, as he was getting ready to
challenge, Goldwater supporter. I mean, the
absolutely. It was just that Reagan was opposed to all concentrations of power, whether it was governmental or corporate, seeing both of them as threats. You know, is that there's an old adage, when the elephants are fighting, the mice are at risk. But when the elephants are making love, the mice aren't much safer.
Right.
and then Reagan understood is that giant corporations and giant governments are threats to individual freedom and rights and privacy. And we see that all the time, whether, you know, the bailout, you know, which took $700 billion out of the backs of middle America to refund these banks that had engaged in all this squander and waste and bad behavior.
But at the same time, you have these different factions that are pulling on a thread that was truly there within Reagan's governance and Reagan's outlook. You know, whether it's you take a look at establishment Republicans and feeling that he was a unifying force within the party.
Sure.
Take a look at this notion of that, you know, New Deal Democrats. I mean, FDR was a hero of the president.
That's right. Absolutely.
But not his policies.
His optimism, his personal behavior, or not his personal behavior, but his projection to the American people. You know, in 1936, FDR is accepting renomination. I interrupt you. I beg your pardon. But he's accepting renomination. And he says to the assembled Democrats in Chicago, I think it was in Chicago in 36, he said, there's a mysterious cycle in human events. Some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans today has a rendezvous with destiny. Reagan is listening. He's on a WHO radio in Des Moines in 1936, and he hears the speech over the broadcast over national radio, and he falls in love with it. So he uses this optimistic rendezvous with destiny in all of his important speeches, including the 64 speech for Goldwater. Mm-hmm. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We will, for our children, the last best hope on earth, or we will sentence them to take a first step into 1,000 years of darkness. So, but his 76 speeches and his 80 acceptance speech, he uses rendezvous with destiny.
So, which element of Reaganism, as you look at the current landscape, the political landscape, the national landscape, do you think is strongest, and which do you think is most at risk?
Yeah. It's almost like being an anomalist on this, Roger, because you see it there, but you don't know who embraces it. And too many people on the right, the Republicans, and on the left misunderstand it. Reaganism at its core is about individuality, optimism, freedom.
Minimal government.
Reagan understands, you know,
are those values alive and well today? Are those core principles? Do you see them there?
In pockets, yes, but not at the Republican National Committee, not at the Republican Conference on Capitol Hill, not in the Senate Republicans, is that I don't see elements much of Reaganism. They invoke Reagan's name, but they don't understand Reagan's philosophy, not much anyway.
And of course, it's those ideals and principles and values that need to be understood in order to be advanced.
Absolutely.
But I think those principles that you've just ticked off actually would align with not just Republicans of any stripe and color, but also, you know, millennials and younger people that may not self-identify as Republican or conservative.
With the advent of the internet and the explosion of entrepreneurship, you would think these millennials would more closely align with libertarianism, Republican conservatism, which, by the way, is that this is such an important point that you're touching on, Roger, is that Reagan's strongest base of support was always voters under 30. Voters under 30 were considered to be a province of the Democratic Party. But in 1980, he and Carter split. They each get 43%. Reagan's reelection, he gets 59% of the overall vote of Americans. He gets 67% of the under 30 vote.
Say that one more time. What percentage?
He gets 67% of the under 30 vote. The oldest man ever
run
for
president.
This is
the Alex P. Keaton vote.
Precisely.
From Family Ties.
Yes, exactly.
We'll do that in the notes for this episode.
But let me tell you, yeah, one other thing that's even more astonishing. When he leaves office in January 1979, his overall approval rating is hovering around 70% among the American people, 70%. There are polls of voters under 30 who give Reagan an 85% approval rating. Voters under 30 give Reagan an 85% approval rating in January of 1989.
I got two questions, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Right.
But one is a follow-on to the point you just made. Why? Why did young people find President Reagan, and is that a function of the man, or is it also the values and the ideals?
Both. Well, you can't separate the two.
85%.
He is his values. He is.
So why would
this
he,
is not some
how
act.
Did he,
this,
how did he get the young people?
Because he talked to them. Because he talked about the future. Because he talked about future of opportunity and vast horizons and moving ahead and acquiring wealth and acquiring knowledge and all these things that a 20-year-old wants to hear. What is Carter preaching in 1980? Scarcity,
right,
rationing, a smaller slice of the shrinking pie. What 20-year-old wants to hear that their future is going to be one of limits and scarcity? And Reagan comes along and says, no. This is America. This is a do-it-yourself enterprise. Is that you can do whatever you want, do it as long as it's legal. You know, maximum freedom consists with law and order, as he said. But you can pursue your dreams. So you can do all these things, and nobody has the right to stop you, because that's the beauty of America. Not like in the Soviet Union or
and
other
collective
states.
That's not because of the consultant. That's the way you talk to the millennials of his time.
Reagan, up until Obama. Reagan and John Kennedy, the only two American presidents who can dare go on college campuses and give speeches without fear of massive protests or reprisals. I have a picture. It's my personal favorite from Reagan's presidency. It's NC State. And it's shot from the back, but you know it's Reagan because he's wearing, first of all, he's wearing a white suit. And how many presidents wear white suits other than, you know, maybe Harry Truman did in the 40s or whatever. But you know it's Reagan. And down in front, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of young college students all applauding and cheering and laughing and having a good time. These 19, 20, 21-year-olds are digging this guy who's the oldest president in history. And but it's what he says and what he believes that inspires them. And so he created a whole generation.
It's not very,
I'm old,
not
I'm
very
old,
different than Bernie Sanders going on a campus.
I'm older than you, and I won't ask how old you are, but I think you're a lot younger than I am or significantly younger than I am. But you probably represent the Reagan generation that came to fruition in the 80s and grew up appreciating the fact that for the first time since John Kennedy, you had a president that inspired you.
Absolutely. So, Greg, if I hear you think these principles of individuality, minimal government, optimism, freedom, right? Those qualities, those principles are alive in pockets.
Yes.
And certainly something that, from a political standpoint, would be, you know, were advantageous for President Reagan. There's no reason not, they wouldn't be today.
Right.
Question. You look at the New Deal and New Deal Democrats, they had a great run with the New Deal.
Sure they did.
FDR
from 19,
through all the way through
1980.
Carter.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe you can argue that Clinton had some of those elements, but for the most part, he was not a New Deal
Clinton
Democrat.
Clinton actually was not absent his overactive libido, he was not a bad president.
So he was not a traditional New Deal Democrat.
Right.
Right? It kind of ended with Carter. And that was a heck of a run. But you look at that, that's basically a 30 to 40-year run
That's right.
So here we are. President Reagan left office in 1988.
Right.
Right? So we're looking at, you know, 30-plus years later.
Right.
Is Reaganism, to the extent that, you know, you have New Deal Democrats, you have Reagan Republicans, is the run over or will the run continue?
No, the run will continue.
Why?
Because there's the power of his ideas. The power of Reaganism, the power of just the sheer logic.
Take
Reagan
logic.
Understood. Because he was also a practical man. If you look at this practically, is that this is now we have 330 million people in this country. It is big, it is vast, it is broad, it's diverse, and it's simply impractical to try to run this country from one corrupt city by the Potomac River. And that the federalism that Reagan embraced makes much more sense. Why should you have Homeland Security in Washington? Why shouldn't Homeland Security should be in the homeland, shouldn't it? Through the 50 states and let them determine their own policies because the homeland policy of Texas is going to be vastly different than the homeland policy of Alaska. So let them determine the same thing, whether it's food stamps or education. Why have, you know, nothing, the Department of Education has done nothing except make SAT scores down and child attendance and high school scores go down, is that they've done nothing good.
So the federalism is a key element that will endure and
it resonates more today, I think, than it ever has since the founding, is that because it just doesn't work. Because all this concentration of power just becomes inept and a threat to individual rights and privacy, which is what it does every day, with the IRS abuses or waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. And that is Reaganism. Reagan brought that back to the Republican Party. The Republican Party had been dead of ideas from the New Deal forward. It was an echo, not a choice. And Reagan brings the real choice back to the Republican Party, where it is today, not as elegant, not as smooth, not as intellectual as Reagan made the case in 76 and 80 and 84.
It was just always value and principle driven.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
But
he got up every morning. He was thinking, every morning I can imagine Reagan got up and said, what can I do to advance the cause of human freedom? What can I do? I mean, that's what animated him, was personal freedom.
Consistent from that moment, a time for choosing, to, you know, to the final word he wrote as he closed out, you know, his time in office. All right, let's go to the fun, quick lightning round portion of our Reaganism podcast. Three questions, quick responses, all about your favorite Reagan thing. So we're going to start, other than your own books, your favorite Reagan book.
Freedom and the Making of History by John Patrick Diggins. John Patrick Diggins was a liberal college professor at Berkeley who did battle with Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan was the governor of California.
You surprised me. I did not think he'd go to Berkeley in response to this question. So
this professor was quite profound. He and I became friends years later before he passed away. He is, in many ways, the unofficial historian of the American left in the 20th century. He writes books about the labor movement, about civil rights movement, about women's movement, about environmental movement. But his last book... His last book, this liberal professor writes a book, Ronald Reagan, Fate, Freedom, and the Making of History. And in that book, I mean, it is a brilliant takedown of neocons and analysis of Reagan and, you know, how he didn't get along with the neocons. They didn't understand him. He didn't want anything to do with them. But it's more than that. It's much deeper than that. In that book, this liberal professor says that Reagan is one of our four greatest presidents, alongside Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt, because... Like those other three presidents, he freed or saved many, many people.
That was the benchmark.
That is the best benchmark, isn't it? Isn't that the best?
Advance the cause of freedom.
Yeah, precisely. Isn't that really the best way to measure a president?
Great. So that's the Reagan book.
Yes, that's a Reagan book.
Surprised me on that one. I have to admit, wasn't aware of that one.
You would enjoy it. I mean, anybody would enjoy it, but you especially.
Favorite Reagan speech.
Actually, his speech in Houston in 1992. I was standing on the floor there, and it's really one...
That's the convention speech.
The convention speech. I mean, he's been out of office for 4 years.
But this is Bush, 41.
Yes, right. Yeah, he's trying to boost 41's chances against Bill Clinton. And it is written by Landon Parvin, but he drafted Reagan, obviously, like all his other speeches, worked on it. And when he gives it, you know it's Reagan's speech. But it is beautiful. It is elegant, it is funny, it is self-deprecating, and I remember being on the floor, I was standing there with my friend Bill Schultz, who's then the Washington editor of Reader's Digest, and at the end of the speech, we're both crying, and I turned to Bill, and he turned to me, and he says, "What are you thinking?" I said, "He's going back to California, we're never going to see him again." Now, see, this is, you know, I can't
this
help
was, this
it.
This is exiting the public stage. Exiting the public stage one final time.
You know, because he was 81 years old when he gave the speech. We all hoped Reagan would have a lot more time left, and he did, although he suffered. But you figure that's going to be his last public speech, or last speech to a convention.
Great one. We'll post that to notes.
And this is what I guess is that... It's so central to my life in the 80s. Serena and I were here, and my wife and I were here in the 80s, working on the Republican National Committee, working on the 80 campaign, working on the 84 campaign. I worked at the White House Conference on Small Business. I had a lot of clients, the Contras, the Mujahideen of Afghanistan, SDI, that tracked closely with administration policy. So I was over at the White House all the time. You know, with conferences and meetings.
You gave me the business of advancing freedom. why the hostility to neocons?
I like tilting at windmills, I guess. I don't know. But the 80s for us was such a halcyon time. It became, for many of us, the defining era. And I often think is that we were young in those days, and we were working for a cause we believed in. We were working for a man we were devoted to, utterly devoted to. And I think that young Democrats who came to Washington in the 60s and had John Kennedy in the White House felt the same way about Kennedy that we did about Reagan.
So. Favorite Reagan quote, and we're going to end with this one.
Maximum freedom consistent with law and order. There are so many.
But that's political philosophy in a nutshell.
That's his political philosophy in a nutshell, is that do whatever you want. But just don't trample on somebody else's rights.
Are we true to that principle today?
No, not nearly enough. Not even close to it. No. Pendulum swung too much the other way with confiscatory tax policy, with regulation of speech on college campuses and political activity on college campuses. Now it's just the opposite. It's not maximum freedom. It's minimum freedom consistent with the liberals' interpretation of justice. Which is really about taking power away from the individual.
Well, if the Reaganism podcast will make any contribution, it's a discussion of freedom. It's going to be one and the same and how we can advance it. And certainly, Craig, through your scholarship and work,
you've advanced
the cause of freedom and certainly advancing the legacy of President Reagan. Thank you for being here in launching our first Reaganism podcast.
My honor, my pleasure. Thank you, Roger, very, very much.
Look forward to having you back on our 100th Reaganism.
Okay.
If not sooner.
We haven't even scratched the surface.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.